My wife Kelly and I have two boys, a three-year-old named Fitz and his little brother Archer, who is one. If you're not a parent of young kids in 2024, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. My evenings, and those of many of my friends, are made up of a repeated series of seven-minute television adventures of an Australian blue heeler named Bluey, her sister Bingo, and their parents Chili and Bandit. My good friend Tarek is to blame for this family obsession. His suggestion that I was missing out on, quote, prestige television, unquote, stirred up my genetically imprinted FOMO and eventually broke our cycle of dependence on the many lower forms of kids' TV, some of which I will keep nameless. But importantly, and perhaps not surprisingly, I find Bluey a fascinating exploration of ownership dynamics in a creative industry. Let me take you to this excerpt from a December 31st edition of the Financial Times titled, How Bluey Conquered Children's Television. The ABC, which broadcast the show in Australia, has defended itself against accusations that it missed out on securing the lucrative rights to the country's golden goose. David Anderson, the ABC's managing director, has argued that Bluey is priceless, that it has brought joy to children around the world. Who knew it was going to be such a unicorn, he said last month on ABC Radio. Luto's decision to partner with public sector broadcasters, as opposed to a streaming giant or private equity-backed media developer, may have contributed to the show's success. Larger, commercially owned companies could have taken creative control away from Brum and Luto, says Diener. The magic could have been kicked out of it and the wealth transferred to a global business. Screen content is a combination of art and commerce. You need to get both working the same way. What is your takeaway, other than a realization that I can't enjoy a good adventure of Bluey and Bingo without analyzing the business dynamics in play? How about this? To understand the creative products we consume and love, we have to pay very close attention to the role of creative ownership control. Only by doing so can we know what it means for the magic to be maintained and what happens behind the scenes when it is lost. This podcast, The Owner's Box, is about telling that story. Bringing you insights on ownership from Washington University in St. Louis Olin School of Business, I'm your host, Peter Baumgarten, professor and director of the Koch Center for Family Enterprise, where we focus on engaging leaders, developing students, and creating cutting-edge research. Today, we look at the tension between commercial and creative objectives and what we can learn from a culinary entrepreneur preparing for his third act.
I don't think I would be great at anything that I really like to do. I wanted to be an architect. I'd love to have been a musician, a painter, a writer, any number of things, but I didn't think I would be great. So I asked them, tell me what to do. And instead of it enhancing my understanding and helping me, it put me backwards because they said, everybody asks for that. And unequivocally, what you should be is an accountant. I think the only accountancy I'm in any way attracted to is actually turf accountancy. And they thought that was brilliant and I should go ahead and do it. And therein lies a little bit of a secret as to why I'm in the hospitality business is because of gambling. And gambling came for me in the form of a book by Luke Reinhardt called The Dice Man, a cult novel in 71, all about a man who determines the future of his life by the throw of a dice.
This is my friend Jeremy King, famed London restaurateur, entrepreneur, dice man by his own account. I met Jeremy as a part of a group of 20 hospitality owners and leaders going through an exercise called Writing Into the Day. The idea behind this tool is that you can be creatively freed up when you put onto a piece of paper a set of free associations. As a person who spends too much time in the university, and a business school at that, my writing came out like a set of bullet points organized into sterile buckets. Jeremy, on the other hand, created meanderings of silk. While this interpretation is likely partly tied to my susceptibility for a good British accent, Jeremy free associates like a creative writer. It's no wonder that he's putting his finishing touches on a memoir in the restaurant industry, titled Food for Thought, due out next February. But if you know anything about Jeremy King, it is not that he is merely a creative writer. Rather, in the context of food, Jeremy and his partner Chris Corbin are widely known as the key players to revolutionize the London food business, all starting with the opening of Le Caprice in September of 1981. Here is how New York Times' Sam Sifton put it in 2010. At its best, the British version of Le Caprice is filled with lords and skeevy barristers, hacks and publicists, actors on the make, drooping aristos, pop stars, and spectacular women. There's a wonderful story about the punk rock chieftain Ian Dury crashing through the place, drunk and outstanding on his cane. It ends with Omar Sharif punching him in the face. You don't hear so much about the food at La Caprice, but a meal there might be a novel in three courses or a short story told in gin and diet pills. But this episode is not centrally a story about a restaurant's founding and closing, no more than it is about Australian prestige children's TV. No, centrally, this is about how an artist creates in the canvas of ownership, sitting between the need to reach traction in the market, all while seeking to maintain the authenticity of craft.
That's great. Well, it does seem relevant that you have these different parts of your career. There's the dice man, there's the gambler, there's the financial accountant, and there's the musician, the writer, the architect, the painter. Really, in a lot of ways, to be a gifted restaurateur requires all three skill sets. You have to craft an experience through hospitality, using the lens, the mentality of the musician, the painter, the architect. You have to be thinking about risk in a certain kind of way, and you have to be doing so with an eye towards the financial piece of it. So I would imagine your career has been kind of a combination of those three pieces to some degree.
Well, of course, annoyingly, but unsurprisingly, you've got to the nub of it very quickly. For me, it took an extra 20, 25 years to realize all those things, that restaurateuring actually encompassed all that I wanted. I get to do my architecture. I get to do my history, my music, my literature. And I become something which I realize as an inherently shy person, I really enjoyed, which is being a catalyst for other things to happen, because that the role of a great restaurateur is if they're a true catalyst. And we use restaurants for any number of reasons, and if we can facilitate what people want of them rather than dominate or dictate, then we have a good business and ways of doing it. But you're absolutely right, of course.
Let me pause here for a moment before we get back to Jeremy. With this cocktail of ingredients outlined, how should we define success? To what extent should a creative act be judged by its commercial success versus any other set of measures? To set the stage, let's take a look at a few other industries. The famed sociologist Matt Desmond, as far as a sociologist can be famous, is a fantastic social scientist who writes on poverty. In 2017, Matt won the Pulitzer Prize for his book Evicted. It's hard to imagine a higher praise for an author than winning the Pulitzer. But before he won the award, his book was number 6,760 on the Amazon bestseller list. The next day, it jumped a lot, but still didn't crack the top 1,000. So, is it fair to judge a work like Desmond's merely by its measurable commercial success? Let's take film as another example. In 2023, Oppenheimer grossed almost $1 billion in the same year it won the Best Picture. The top film, Barbie, took home almost $1.5 billion. All things considered, while the financial gap is large, this left these films as number one and number three in the commercial top of the list, and relatively close in comparison. But looking back to 2022, the winner, Everything Everywhere at Once, grossed $143 million, with the box office winner taking home almost $2.3 billion. In 2021, the top grossing film sat at $1.9 billion, with Coda winning Best Picture with $1.9 million of sales, a ratio of 1 in 1,000 for total revenue. So, how do we judge what it means for a book, a film, or a restaurant to be a success? Here is Jeremy on his interpretation in the context of food.
I think with most businesses, it's only ever going to be considered a great success by your customers and your audience. And I think that many a restaurateur, entrepreneur, industrialist, whatever, underestimates the power of the audience, and that they smell cynicism very quickly. That can work in the short term. I work on the basis that I say to the staff, and off-quoted, that you must never, ever look at somebody walking through the door as a source of income. What you must do is look at them coming through the door as an opportunity, and the opportunity is to give somebody a good time, because I firmly believe if you give them a good time, then you make money.
There is no doubt a relationship between creativity and commerce, but that link is imperfect. A great restaurant, as defined by its product put out to the customer, might nonetheless struggle to make it financially. In the spring and summer of 2020, right after the pandemic start, take a look at the closings of critically acclaimed Prune in New York City and Blackbird in Chicago as prime examples. A film highly regarded for its artistic quality that does a fraction of the sales of a less regarded but more commercially successful alternative would also fit that bill. We need different mental models to think about these different versions of success. Maybe that's why I like Jeremy's distinction between a restaurateur and a restaurant owner. In many ways, we can think of this as the difference between the investor and the operator, the player coach and the coach merely on the sideline. There is something about being close to the craft that changes one's relationship with the product produced. Don't get me wrong, being too close to the product is not always a good thing. Proximity to craft might make it hard to separate one's love of the thing from the ability to do so with scale or profit. I see this in the engineer whose love for a product can constrain their ability to see whether or not it can easily exist in the marketplace. I've seen an owner-operator get out in front of their skis as the enterprise becomes much more complex than the entity they started with, and yet still fail to step away. Sometimes the founder is not the right person to take a company to the next level. So, what is this skill of a good owner in a creative field? This is something we think about a lot at the Koch Center, an essential question guiding our work with current and future owners. On the one hand, skill for ownership requires intimate knowledge of how to make something work in a marketplace. Consider Jeremy's decades of experience on the floors of London restaurants. Think as well of the producers of Bluey and the years paying attention to the craft of children's television. In and of themselves, these experiences help make for a great product. But so too, it is a technical skill set of building out the operational model. If you want to increase your pay for workers out of a conviction to build a wonderful workplace, as Danny Meyer modeled in our last episode, can you make the financial calculus work? To be a strategic owner, the gambler needs constraints. The artist needs an accountant. So, back to the start of the transformation of the London restaurant scene and the role of La Caprice in this evolution. Let's zero in on the artistic impulse and see how that evolved into a core operating model over time. Here is Jeremy again on the initial vision.
I think to a degree we were transformational with the restaurants. We introduced things which are standard today, which were innovative in those days. But one of the biggest impediments, which would be difficult to understand in many ways for an American sensibility, is that the restaurants were very much beset by class structure. You had in that great old British tradition, I say that ironically, they have an upper class restaurant, a middle class restaurant, and a working class restaurant. And none of those three restaurants should cross over. And to put it really into context, in 1981, when Chris and I opened the Caprice, which was innovative in so, so many different ways, design-wise as well, they did a survey in the UK as to how often people ate out at what one might call a white tablecloth restaurant during the course of the year. And bear in mind that even in those days, there were still people who were eating out 100, 200, 300 times a year, particularly in the metropolitan side. The survey came back, the average in the country is less than once a year, less than once. What it is now, I don't know. It may not be that much higher, but it's probably 400 or 500% higher. And it was, for me, that was the excitement. Because the gambling element in me really transformed into a desire to be different against a background of also being a great egalitarian, a convinced and confirmed egalitarian, which I learned from my schooling because I went to a charity school where you only paid fees according to how much your parents earned, and it meant you had anything from fallen aristocracy through to East Ender, the comparative projects type situation. Fantastic. Everybody was given the same uniform. Everybody was the same deep down. And it meant a great deal to me. And in the way that I said, we must cross the boundaries. And we must take some of this upper class restaurant stuff and the working class restaurant and make it understood that a lot of the most interesting people who go into a restaurant are actually not the most affluent. And this is a restaurateur mistake, is that the really fascinating people who often come from the arts actually don't have that much income. And it becomes very, very significant. That's what my socialism is about. And it's a very pertinent thing in Britain, because there used to be the old joke would be that the worker standing at the factory gates watching the boss come out in the UK in their Rolls Royce will say, I'm going to make sure you don't get two of those. Whereas often the equivalent American worker standing at the gates sees the Cadillac or whatever it is coming out the gate and says, I'm going to have two of those myself. And it's a very different mentality. And Britain is still, unfortunately, beset by it.
The entrepreneur imagines and invents out of experience. They create out of the corpus of unique insights that they bring into the world. For Jeremy, his attention to class structure began in charity schooling and led to insights into hospitality experience design. This need for deep and rich experience is perhaps part of what is behind the research by Pierre Azoulay and colleagues' 2020 piece in the American Economic Review. Their research explores a link between age of entrepreneur and fast-growing startups. The key headline, an entrepreneur's average age when founding a company for the 1 in 1,000th fastest-growing startups was 45. And this effect held when looking into high-tech sectors and entrepreneurial hubs and controlling for whether an entrepreneur had previously had a successful exit. Age provides for rich experiences, generating insights on opportunities for industry transformation. In other words, I'm young for an entrepreneur. I still have hope. But while experience matters, few of us have all the experiences we need. This is where teams can help. Remember, Jeremy was the artist, the accountant, the gambler. What helped make him into a successful restaurateur? For Jeremy, this combination was found in partnership.
The interesting thing about my partnership is that Chris was fairly classically trained in restaurateuring, even did chef work. I was entirely autodidact, and I was very reliant on him for setting up the principles of how a restaurant should operate. Because without him doing that, I couldn't deconstruct it, which was essential. So we worked on that basis. And what I realized, again, as so often in retrospect, is that the reason our relationship worked is because it wasn't competitive. And whether it's business relationships or domestic relationships, there's often a lot of competition and inherent latent resentment, many other facets. And what it came down to is that if we had contrary views, my way of dealing with it is to look for the virtue in his argument as opposed to shooting it down. And I would then expect him to look for the virtue in my argument. And because if you do it that way, there's a chance that the two of you say, actually, we both have a good points, but we could, if we combine that, we could make it even better. And that's what I think was fundamental to our relationship.
In part two of today's podcast, we will hear more from my interview with Jeremy, focusing on the role of control and ownership in his battle with Minor International and how this experience shaped his planned relaunch into the restaurant scene later this summer. I want to take this moment to share a few things happening at WashU in and around ownership. As part of our mission to develop students, the Koch Center is proud to support the Entrepreneurship Through Acquisition Club in its inaugural year. Starting a business from scratch can be daunting. Entrepreneurship Through Acquisition, buying a company and then seeking opportunities for growth, offers a unique alternative. In addition to taking courses on ownership insights and ETA, members of the ETA Club host networking events at WashU, attend national conferences, and participate in training from Train the Street to develop the skills required to conduct a successful search. Visit the quick links menu on the Koch Center page on the Olin website at olin.woostel.edu to learn more. Let's return to the exact moment I met Jeremy. Jeremy and I met in March 2022. This matters because one of the first things he shared with a group of us was that he was in the midst of a legal battle of which he couldn't directly speak. A few weeks later, I opened the New York Times to see a photo of Jeremy, suited up only as he can do, alongside the headline, "The consummate London restaurateur is briskly shown the exit." Here is the backstory as captured by the Times' Mark Landler. The corporate owner in question is a Bangkok-based hospitality giant, Miner International, which bought 74% of Mr. King's company, Corbin & King, for £80 million, or about $75 million in 2017. The new investors said Mr. King blocked their attempts to expand his restaurants to Asia and the Middle East. They said Corbin & King was weeks away from insolvency, a crisis they blamed on mismanagement in the pandemic, which forced its 9 restaurants to shut down for months. Jeremy was losing a great deal of money, says William E. Heineke, an American billionaire who is the chairman of Miner. All I wanted to do was to see this company grow and look after its employees. In London's sympathetic news media, Mr. King's feud has been framed as a classic David and Goliath tale. While it is true that Mr. Heineke used bare-knuckles tactics, it is also true that Mr. King brought him in as a partner, eager for cash to bankroll his ambitions in an expensive market. And Mr. King, 67, has fallen out with at least 2 previous partners, a testament to his uncompromising style. Let's put Jeremy in here to tell his side of the story.
My second iteration as a restaurateur with investors, and ended up falling out incredibly badly with my investors. Now, that might single me out as being a difficult person. I don't think so. I am a very wholehearted person until we go into what I would call the Steve Jobs phenomenon, who, and I may be paraphrasing badly, but my understanding of it is that Steve Jobs used to say that one of the great tragedies of big business and smaller business is that big business, and he was talking very much about Apple, sees innovation, sees somebody doing something different, really tearing up the rule book creatively. And we as big business, he said, will look at that and say, God, that's brilliant. We have to have some of that. And they're either going to invest or they're going to acquire that company because they're brilliant, because they're innovative, because they're different, because they're really, really making new tracks in the business world. And he said, what do we do as soon as we've got them? We start telling them how to do it. And that happens time and time again, as far as I'm concerned, within the business world. And that it becomes a tragedy of so many relationships instead of celebrating the differences. And in a world where to be contrary is frowned upon, homogenization and precedent is becoming a driving force for everybody. Everywhere we look, it's about precedent. It's about precedent. And everybody's, whether you're making a film, or in my world, creating a hotel or a restaurant, etc., you copy other people. And that's why in the film world, when somebody actually comes out with something extraordinary and different and bold and brave, then it suddenly knocks everything over like Skittles and people have to rethink it. And mercifully, every few years, we have to rethink the industries we're in. And if we don't do that, we're finished. In the way that Kodak didn't think that they needed change, or to a degree IBM, or any of those of the great monsters. You don't change your principles, your ethics, your morals, or anything like that. You just change the way you do it. Otherwise, you have no chance.
Jeremy, I want to do 2 more themes of questions. So we've been talking, obviously, about the start and your partnership early on, and having a kind of a creative tension between someone trained within the restaurant industry and someone who's kind of pushing against it, but an agreement that you needed one another. So the next 2 are going to be looking forward to your relationship with your investor in Miner International. And then the second piece is going back to kind of what you're doing now in this newer version. So Jeremy, as you know, we got to know each other in the spring of 2021, 2 years ago. And at that time you were going through a dispute with your investor. So you talked about the importance of kind of control, concentrated ownership, and how that allowed for a certain kind of creative vision. And at the same point, then there was a relationship when you became a minority owner of the business with what you thought was going to be a more aligned partner. So when you contrast the kind of ownership that you had with your partner at the beginning, a creative tension between two backgrounds and experiences when there was listening to one another, with what happened later on with Minor International, what is different about it? Is it primarily about the lack of control? Is it primarily about the difference between someone who's a restaurateur versus an owner from the boardroom? What was the different nature of that relationship, and what has it told you about the value and areas for caution when it comes to seeking outside investment?
I mean, notwithstanding the Steve Jobs test on any relationship, I do think, particularly in my world, the control becomes everything. And the number of businesses I've seen, it's like in publishing. A really good publisher can attract a much bigger publisher or media group because they've been doing so well. And then there comes that moment that they have the opportunity to buy the memoir of somebody for X million dollars or pounds. And then it becomes opinion. And too often within businesses, elements get decided by committees. And well, first of all, this is not a democracy, because democracy and business do not mix. I'm not entirely sure democracy and politics work that well together, although, you know, there's a lot of qualifications right on that. The main difference is that this is a benign dictatorship. Not a malignant one, but a benign one. I mean, I like the definition of leadership, which somebody said rather eloquently recently. Leadership is not about being in charge. It's about looking after people in your charge. And it's important to protect them from themselves, because we are, in my industry, and I think in too many industries, inherently reactionary and conservative. And to that end, have to be protected from ourselves. When it came to investment, you asked me about Minor. It was a very simple thing with Minor. I think there was an element of gambling on my part. I thought rationally and somewhat logically that if anybody is going to understand the hospitality industry and the problems and the vagaries and challenges, it's going to be another hospitality industrial people. But we had a very different mentality. And that was, I tried to explain that right from the beginning. I tried to explain that because although I didn't have the majority shareholding, I had the controls, and it was part of it, and they couldn't understand why I negotiated that so hard. And I explained how it works is that if I was to come to you and say, I mean, I had a restaurant called Colbert, which was doing extremely well, and I was, in 2017, I said, if I was to ask you to finance me to open 10 of these restaurants, you might say no. And all I ask is that you explain that and you say, you know, post-Brexit, we're worried about the economy, staffing's going to be difficult, the sector's overheated, there's so on and so forth. Sorry, we can't support you. And I would say, fair enough. And actually, you'd be right. And I wouldn't in 1,000 years dream of opening 10 of those restaurants. I just wouldn't do that. The point being, though, is can you deal with the fact that you can't tell me to open 10 restaurants? Because that's where it goes wrong with investors, is that particularly if the majority shareholding feel you do it. And I said, then you have to deal with the fact that I won't open Woolsey in a in Bangkok or whatever, because I don't think it's appropriate. But ultimately, my advice to anybody is keep control, keep control, keep control. And I help a lot of people open restaurants. I say open modest, open small, open with control.
Does Jeremy's narrative bring us full circle to Bluey? Clearly, the creative visionary sees something different from the investor. At the same point, when does the investor bring a necessary pragmatism into a creative endeavor? And when is this perspective merely a move from authenticity? At the very least, one particularly important piece is the need for investor alignment. Danny made this very point on the last episode. You get the investors you deserve, he said, channeling his inner Warren Buffett. If you desire a blend of creative and commercial, what are the ways to structure an investment to get the appropriate balance of these two factors moving forward? In our final section, we return to Jeremy's relaunch into the London restaurant scene this summer, his so-called third act, and ask how the investor structure in the owner's box and his evolution as a leader might generate a different outcome.
Well, let's go to the final question here. And in particular, I want to be now thinking forward. And in July of 2023, you announced a relaunch of three new restaurants with the idea of a new model in place, also a new approach to thinking about investors behind that model. So as you think about this third phase of your life, I think you were quoted in the Financial Times as everyone should have three careers. This is your third version of it. What are some of the lessons that you pulled from your experience with Minor or your original partner, your insights around control and ownership, that has shaped how you think about your ownership strategy for this next venture?
It's actually, in many ways, bringing together a lot of what we've been talking about not doing the shoulds, only doing the wants, not allowing anybody to dictate. This is my third restaurant career, so to speak. I did the merchant banking and so on. Is actually how I work with the staff. And I'm really, really excited about empowerment and belief and true delegation. I'm indebted to a man called David Kershaw. He used to run M&C Saatchi. And when I was reorganizing the company years ago, I went to him and I said, how do you do this? You've got four partners, you've got about 20 companies, any number of CEOs, MDs, and so on. How do you do it? And he said, it's all about delegation. I said, oh, come on, David. You know, that's what everybody says. But what does that mean? He said, well, it's very simple. You know the first rule of delegation, don't you? And I said, I don't know, probably. Tell me, what is it? And he said, it's very simple. You never, ever delegate anything whatsoever to anyone at all unless you have complete and utter confidence in their ability to do the task you've delegated. Do you do that? And I said, no, I don't think I do. I think I get into the shoulds. They are the restaurant manager. They should know how to do this. And actually, over the years, I started to recognize in people that we play to their strengths. In a football world, you don't buy Lionel Messi, who is it, for Miami, and put him in goal. You play them in position and you work out what their strengths are. And in microcosm, the number of times I've watched a chef de partie, that's the person who will be on the stoves, being turned into a brilliant chef de partie turned into a useless sous chef through promotion. And I always say, promote them, give them the money of the higher position, leave them on the stoves. People will be happier. Let's make people happy. Let's delegate. Let's trust them. Let's empower them. And I've learned so much through thinking this through, particularly against a background in this industry where staff are not valued or valued even less. They're trained less. Any number of things. This is the time when I'm really going to enjoy it. And again, I talked to her, I said, it's not enough that we've done it before. We've got to find the new paradigms, the new adventures, the new excitement. And I want to empower you. And that's actually, I'm deriving more enjoyment from that than anything.
This summer, 2 full years after his battle with Minor, Jeremy King returns to the restaurant floor. In this relaunch, he brings a new ownership model and applies it to three new and in many ways reimagined restaurant concepts. Arlington, named after the original location, started taking reservations just last month. The Park, just up the way from Kensington Gardens, will launch in May. And Simpsons in the Strand, what Jeremy calls one of the last grand damn restaurants, will open in the fall. It's going to be quite the third act. Maybe the owner's box needs a creative tension between commerce and creativity. Without the constraints of the latter, the creative impulse can easily become unbounded from an assessment of market potential. But lacking the imagination of the creative, what happens to our creative markets? Do we merely replicate previous successes, with all restaurants looking like carbon copies of surefire but overly vanilla hits, and all films becoming superhero replicas whose only ambition is to capture an audience hungry for something familiar? If this is the case, it has to be true that this creative tension is easier to hold to in different ownership and governance forms. For Jeremy, his earlier models didn't work for either party, albeit for different reasons. In his third act, we will see if a new investment model and distinct approach to leadership generates different outcomes. This is a creative strategy from the owner's box, and one that will have implications for the future of the London restaurant season, likely long after the conclusion of Jeremy King's third act. Thank you, as always, for joining the Owner's Box, a show where we explore what it means to be strategic from the position of company ownership. In our next episode, we will explore a world of sports from the literal Owner's Box and what it means to launch a franchise with the stated intent of high performance and urban transformation. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Overcast, or others. Many thanks to our creative producers, Jennifer Windsor and Austin Allred, for all they do to support this work. Until next time.